Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
This is John West for ID the Future. Dr. Charles Garner is an associate professor of chemistry at Baylor University in Texas. Dr. Garner conducts research that sheds light on the issue of the origin of life from non-life. Dr. Garner is one of the scientists who aren't supposed to exist. He's skeptical of current theories of biological and chemical evolution. On January 21, 2009, Dr. Garner was invited to advise the Texas Board of Education on their revision of state science standards. Here's the audio from Dr. Garner's presentation.
Okay, I wanted to thank the board and Dr. McElroy for having me speak here today. I appreciate the opportunity. And I also wanted to thank the Board of Education for all the hours you put on behalf of the students of Texas. I think it's a job that comes with very little appreciation. I got into science because I really love the subject. And in particular, I like chemistry and astronomy the most. I especially like to discover new knowledge about the way molecules behave as a chemist. And I think about things in terms of molecules very much in a molecular way. My research is based in organic synthesis. That means new ways to make organic molecules. And in particular, I work with chiral compounds, which means compounds that can exist as two mirror images. You might say right-handed and left-handed molecules. These have a lot of applications, it turns out, to living systems, as I'll show in a moment. This is a photograph from my laboratory. I still get into the lab occasionally, which I find keeps me excited about science, and I communicate that enthusiasm to my students in teaching and research. Now, one of the questions before us is, are there weaknesses in scientific theories? And you might substitute the word hypotheses there, or just explanations. There's the statements have been made that theories have no weaknesses. Well, even if you took that to be true, does that mean you don't talk about the weakness of hypotheses or other explanations? Are theories somehow sacred? I think there's an effort, in fact, to redefine or to establish what theories and how they differ from hypotheses that's not best done in the state board standards, rather done in the science community as a whole. Okay, there certainly can be weaknesses in scientific theories. And I want to address how did life get started. This is something I have some expertise in, and it's a major question. This is probably the major question of science, actually. What we know is that life needs proteins. At least every living thing that there is highly dependent on proteins, very complex proteins. Proteins are made of amino acids. And amino acids are molecules that exist in right and left-hand forms. But it turns out living things use only left-handed forms entirely. Now, this is a major problem because all abiogenic ways to make amino acids, and there are some, I think everyone's heard of Miller-Urey experiments and things like that, make amino acids as mixtures of right-handed and left-handed, usually as 50-50 mixtures, almost without exception. And so the question is, how could only left-handed forms have ever joined together to make the kinds of molecules that are required for living systems to exist? Now, one possible proposal would be that perhaps a left-handed form getting ready to react with another molecule seeks out left-handed forms, that it has some preference, left-handed for left-handed, maybe right-handed for right-handed. And this is something we can study. In organic chemistry terms, we'd refer to this as stereoselectivity of peptide bond formation here. And this is an experiment we can study. What I did in the laboratory, we took an L, or a left-handed version of the amino acid alanine, and let it react with a 50-50 mixture. In other words, the left and right-handed versions of alanine. We're going to do this under conditions where the two molecules are known to couple. That doesn't occur spontaneously in nature, but you can do it in the laboratory. And what we're going to see is, does the left-hand form of alanine seek out the left-handed form or the right-handed form, or is there no real preference here? Okay. I chose to study this by a technique called capillary gas chromatography. It's one of my favorite techniques in the laboratory. And so what you're seeing here is a capillary GC. Each of the peaks in this chromatogram is a different chemical. So each peak is a different compound. And the part that I want you to focus on is here. Those are the two compounds that are relevant to this reaction. And in fact, one of those is the LL isomer, and one is the LD isomer. In other words, left-left and left-right. And you notice that they're obtained in 50-50 ratio. In other words, there is no selectivity to this process. Now, this is only one example. We, in fact, did a 4x4 study. We took four different left-handed amino acids. We took four different mixtures of left and right. So we generated a table of 16 results. And, in fact, in none of those results was there a significant difference in stereoselectivity. You'd see a little bit of more of the, of one in some, more of the other in some, but nothing really significant. And this, in fact, has been studied by other researchers by using different techniques than gas chromatography, and they found the same thing. Never has anyone observed any significant stereoselectivity in these reactions, which is a major problem, because if you think about molecules in biological systems, this is a rather simple one. This is insulin. You all recognize that as a critical molecule in the treatment of diabetes. Insulin has 51 amino acids, which is relatively small as biomolecules go. And each of these circles represents an amino acid. You'll notice they have lots of different names here, and they're in particular orders. Now, there are 20 amino acids that occur commonly in proteins. And so there's lots of different kinds here. Well, it turns out for insulin to work, you have to have the exact or very nearly exact combination of these. They have to be in this order. Generally, if you change even one of those to a different amino acid or switch any two of them, you get something that doesn't function as insulin. Occasionally, you'll get something that has very weak activity, but generally speaking, you lose all activity in these situations. But I don't want to focus on the order of the amino acids. Let's assume that's not a problem. Let's just think about what happens if you let each of these amino acids be either right or left-handed. Because in insulin, in living systems, every one of those is a left-handed amino acid. Now, you can see that you're going to get a lot of possibilities. With 51 places to have either right or left-handed isomers, there's going to be a whole lot of possibilities. And in fact, if you incorporate L and D indiscriminately somehow in making insulin, you get a huge number of compounds possible. Now, to put that number into perspective, that is a million billion possibilities. And out of that million billion molecules, exactly one of those molecules would be insulin. And maybe 6 or 8 or 10 of those molecules would have the biological activity of insulin or something even approaching it. The vast majority would have none of the desired behavior. And it turns out this is even worse in bigger molecules. Enzymes are the real workhorses of cells, and enzymes are much larger. You know, this has 51 amino acids. Enzymes have between 200 and 2,000 amino acids typically. So the problem of making those, making them in the right order, is huge. And in fact, evolutionary theory, or this branch of evolutionary theory known as chemical evolution, that term was not invented by creationists, has never come up with a plausible explanation for this. So one question I have, will students be taught to evaluate the plausibility of scientific explanations? Okay. This is the standard in the Earth and Space Science 13F, discussing origin of life. And it uses the word discuss here. Now, notice there's nothing about strengths and weaknesses at all. Now, there's nothing really wrong with the wording, but is there anything in that wording that would lead the student to know about what I just talked about the kinds of chemical problems there are in origin of life? Or are they just going to discuss relevant theories without any reference to the problems? What if the best scientific theory ends up not being very plausible? Do you hide the weakness of that theory because there's no naturalistic alternative? What is the goal, to educate or something else? Now, I want to put this in context of current biology textbooks where this is always found. In high school biology books, there's no mention typically, there might be exceptions, but typically there's no mention of these kind of problems. Well, what's the reality of the scientific community? There is no consensus. No one has any idea how this could come about in any plausible way. There are things floated around, but in fact, not very plausible. And to give you just, I could spend a lot of time on this and get produce a lot more evidence, but let me just leave it at this. Dr. George Whiteside's a prominent professor at Harvard University who's an expert on chemical evolution. He's part of the Harvard Origin of Life Project, has in less than a year ago termed this astonishingly improbable or used similar wording. I heard him at an American Chemical Society conference last April say that he has no idea how life could have gotten started, knowing all the chemistry he knows. And I think there are very few people on the planet that know more chemistry than he knows. I would say any theory we're teaching is worth teaching well. Okay, why leave parts out? Whether you call it a theory or a hypothesis, why leave out things that are weaknesses? Now, one statement was made by Dr. Wetherington that there are no weaknesses in theories, or very few theories have weaknesses. There's only weaknesses in the data. I really don't think you can distinguish between weaknesses in the data versus weakness in the theory. Doesn't that rather assume that the data is going to come sooner or later? You have to build your theory from existing data, not data that you hope will come along someday. My recommendation on the Earth and Space Science Origin of Life standard is to add a critical thinking component. I would say critically evaluate strengths and weaknesses of prominent scientific hypothesis for origin of life in light of the complexity of living systems. Okay, you present evidence in proportion to the problem being explained. Okay, and if you don't talk about origin of life in terms of the complexity of a living cell, you just talk about in terms of simple organic molecules forming polymers or something like that, you have essentially deceived your students and done a poor job of communicating the state of the science. I would also recommend including an origin of life component in the biology text as well. And there's several reasons for this. Chemical evolution is foundational to all biological evolution. You can't evolve life until you get life. It turns out every biology text currently includes this topic in the book. There's not as much time devoted to it as there is to biological evolution, but it's in every single book. And finally, I would say many students will not have an opportunity to take the Earth and Space Science capstone course, being that it's typically a fifth science and not totally acceptable to all the students' schedules that way. Now, in terms of weaknesses in theories, I wanted to say a little bit. There can be several types of weaknesses in theories or hypotheses or whatever you want to call it. There can be theories for which there's just very little evidence. Okay, there might not be much evidence against it, but there's really not much evidence for it. What do you do about that? And I would say one of the such theory would be natural variation and natural selection making major changes in body plans. You know, essentially the gist of evolution here. And in fact, this particular point is really the problem most people have with evolution. I wanted to say one thing about Dr. Wetherington's presentation. He acted as though you accept evolution or reject it as a whole, that if you doubt any part of it, you doubt the whole thing. Couldn't it be that different aspects of the theory are more strongly supported than others, that some are correct, some maybe are incorrect? Why is it a take-it-or-leave-it approach when it comes to evolution like that? Okay, and this particular point, not the idea that evolution can accomplish minor changes, not even the idea that there might be common ancestry among all living things. Clearly, there's no doubt that all living things are related in some way. But what is the mechanism of that change? Okay, the natural variation, natural selection is unconvincing to many people. And in fact, there's been a scientific dissent from Darwinism's statement signed by over 700 PhD scientists on this very issue. This is exactly what this dissent from Darwinism statement refers to. And I would like to have this distributed to the board, if you would. Okay, what other kinds of weaknesses can there be in theories? There can be evidence both for and against a theory, perhaps. And I would say a theory like that would be the fossil record in gradualism. The kind of gradualism predicted by Darwin is not always seen in the fossil record. And in fact, you'll recall the debate between Stephen Jay Gould and other proponents of evolution. Stephen Jay Gould said there were sudden jumps, whereas Darwin's theory predicts gradual increases. And so I'd say this is one where there's evidence both for and against the theory. And then there are theories that are known to be only approximations of reality. Okay? And here's one in chemistry. The ideal gas law. Okay? No gases behave exactly like the gas law predicts, and yet we teach it in chemistry. Now, ideally, we teach that with the understanding that the students know not any gases formally follow exactly that behavior. Another one is Newtonian mechanics. Was thought for a long time to be an exact description of physics, the behavior of physical objects, and it's now known to be an approximation, a very good approximation in most cases. Theories of the ancient past are especially susceptible to weaknesses, and I wanted to point this out, okay, for several reasons. Now, parts of astronomy, geology, and biology deal with the ancient past, and this is where this occurs most often. When you're talking about the ancient past, you're not talking about direct observations. Evidence is harder to come by. A lot of time has passed. A lot of the evidence you would look for is gone, covered up, destroyed, whatever. You can't replicate the event in the laboratory, not usually. The evidence is circumstantial, not direct, and this means your conclusions necessarily are limited or tentative. In other words, you can say things like the evidence is consistent with, but not usually the evidence demonstrates that or proves that. There's always a degree of uncertainty in the ancient past that you can't deal with like you can things in the present. Dr. Wetherington referred to the experiments with the string and the washers, the pendulum speed. That's something you can vary in the lab and test to your heart's content. You can't do that with ancient theories. Now, the tentativeness of these claims is especially important when the claims that are made are extraordinary. Now, let's think about some extraordinary claims. Well, the first living systems coming from simple chemicals arranging themselves in ways that have never been observed, I'd say, is an extraordinary claim. Natural variation, natural selection, accounting for all the diversity of life, especially the major changes, is pretty extraordinary. Here's one from astronomy. Most of the universe is composed of dark matter and dark energy. Now, the claim is made that only evolution is a subject of weaknesses, but I would say not. I've shown you one from astronomy here, and even one from chemistry, you might say, the ideal gas law. Carl Sagan said, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. If you're not going to teach weaknesses for things like this and for others, you better have extraordinary evidence. And in fact, many people are unconvinced in a lot of ways. These all need to be taught, examined critically, not just assumed. Okay, let's look at the wording that removes the discussion of weaknesses from the text standards. For the first part, it's common to all, to both versions. The current text, of course, has the words critique, scientific explanations for strength and weaknesses. What this is getting at is the plausibility of the explanation. Okay? Now let's see what's there now. The word evaluate. Now the word evaluate is supposed to do everything that the other words were supposed to do, right? Well, I want to know how the word evaluate is intended to be used. Now if you look at the definition of evaluate, it can mean to determine the value of, which is a good definition. It can mean to look at the significance, worth, or condition of. Now, in a scientific context, is that 15 minutes?
Can he finish?
Is that 15 minutes?
15 minutes.
That's 15?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Keep going.
I'd like him to finish since others were allowed to finish.
Okay, thank you. This is the significance of a theory, the worth or condition of a theory. Now, how will you evaluate that without reference to strength and weaknesses? And there are weaknesses. Conclusions. Some scientific theories do have significant weaknesses. I've shown you one from my research. Inclusion of weaknesses in science is necessary for critical thinking. Would you want a student to learn about origin of life without knowing the sorts of things I talked about today? Some people might say there's not time in the classroom for such things. Well, I didn't take much time to teach you about that little bit of chemistry. And I would say the purpose of removing the strength and weaknesses language from the standards must be to remove, in fact, all discussion of strength and weaknesses from the classroom. Why else would it be undertaken? Would removing that kind of critical thinking prepare students for the 21st century? And will the State Board of Education allow that to happen? And I would leave you with this. If you don't acknowledge unanswered questions and the weaknesses in theories that those questions sometimes imply, then you're leaving the students to go with unquestioned answers, which is essentially dogma. Thank you.
For ID of the Future, this is John West. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2008. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.